people, welcome to Private Equity Laid Bare, the podcast. I'm your host, Ludovic Falipou, and today it's a pleasure to have Kajal with me, who's going to talk to us about due diligence. So Kajal, thank you so much for taking the time. And can you tell us a bit more about yourself and what is due diligence exactly about?
Sure. Hello, everyone. Thanks a lot. Very, very glad to be here today. I'm Kajal Bhattabhiyal. I'm a director in EY Parthenon Strategy and Transactions team. And my group at EY, we support both private equity as well as corporates across a range of transaction situations, such as mergers, acquisitions, divestments, bolt-ons, and so on. I specifically focus on private equity transactions and specialize in what we refer to as pre-deal services. So that would include due diligence, value creation, exit readiness, and sign-to-close support. Now, within this area of work, my expertise is in assessing the value impact from technology and digital elements of a target company. With that in mind, I mean, that's sort of short of what I do. It's a very exciting space. It's great to be involved in deals and in the private equity environment as such. In terms of sort of due diligence, I mean, what is due diligence, right? So what I would say is it's carried out when, say, a private equity firm is looking at different businesses and trying to take a decision on whether to purchase the business or not. And what due diligence basically aims to do is help the PE firm or a corporate buyer in understanding what's the right valuation or price of the business, in sort of assessing the risks or any inherent risks within the business. And thirdly, I would say also trying to understand what are the future value creation opportunities. So what can be done to the business? What can be improved? What should be the future growth strategy? So these three areas,
This was kind of a job of private equity firms but in a sense you're offering an outsourcing solution to them, I guess, right? You would put it this way. So does that mean that then it's mainly smaller private equity firms that hire you, or even big private equity firms would hire you because nobody would have quite such a precise expertise like the one you described on, like, you know, measuring in due diligence the impact that technology can play or things like that?
Exactly. I mean, and that's exactly that. Different private equities have different approaches. I mean, there are some PE firms who have an in-house, who have in-house experts who do the due diligence in certain areas, but they hire advisors in other areas. And there are certain private equity firms, most likely the large ones, who hire advisors in sort of different areas of the due diligence to sort of provide that viewpoint. So it's a mix. Usually I would say smaller PE firms have performed their own diligence, whereas the mid-market and large cap PE firms normally hire advisors. And to your point, it is driven by the fact that advisors like me, I mean, we do this day in, day out, right? So we get, firms like EY or even McKinsey, BCG, Bain, PwC, they have in-house expertise around the different types of businesses, the sector expertise, as well as, you know, knowing the issues in businesses or the value creation points in businesses. So
but
it's driven by that. Yeah.
It's still a bit counterintuitive because usually you outsource when you are smaller and then you can insource when you are larger. So is it because the smaller private equity firms are more specialized and so they, you know, they do only one kind of deals and so they know these deals and so they do it themselves, and the large guys do a bit of everything so they need to hire externals like you?
Yeah, and I think that's right. But even within large private equity firms as well, I think there are certain, like one example is Blackstone, right? So Blackstone does a mix. I mean, they have their own operating partners or operations teams. They have their own data science teams who get involved in looking at companies, but then they also bring in advisors where they don't see the value in maintaining an internal team. I think it is also driven by the deal volume that each PE does. So if there are private equity firms that do a lot of deals, it makes sense to maintain an internal team and utilize them. And if there is a deal, if there are PE firms who look at, say, slightly fewer deals, then I think it doesn't make sense. So which PE firms maintain an internal team and which sort of hire advisors, it differs a bit by the size as well as the approach that they take in terms of their own business model, if that makes sense.
And does it make a difference if it's a private equity firm versus a corporate that is asking for due diligence services, or it's just always the same thing? It's just, it's about the company, first of all. It doesn't matter who the client is, whether it's a corporate sponsor or a private equity firm. Or does it make a difference because the corporate sponsor usually wants to think a lot more about synergy and private equity firms about something else, about like an exit in 4 years?
No, there is a slight nuance difference. So one thing with corporate, as you say, yes, they're looking at synergies, but more importantly, because a corporate would have their own experts, right? There are people within the firm who run their own, say, operations team, their own technology team, or their legal team. So very often the corporates actually bring in their own people, so because they have the company itself. But even then, the corporates, they hire advisors because they want additional bandwidth, because the people within the company, they're doing their day jobs. And they're, I mean, they may not, while they may be experts in the specific functions, they are usually not experts of the whole M&A process. So in corporate, it's normally M&A advisors who work alongside the functional people to look at the target company. In a private equity, it's almost like they are not in the business of advising. So they don't maintain an internal team to do the due diligence. So they are more akin to hiring advisors to help them with the deals.
No, that's brilliant. And in terms of, do you have an example like of a due diligence on a deal, even if it's anonymous, like so that we get a sense of how much work it is, what kind of work it is, what kind of solutions you bring?
Sure, of course. Let me talk about a recent chemicals deal that I worked on, right? So it was a very large chemicals company. I'm not going to name it, but it was a very large chemicals company who was divesting a division. Me and my team, we were supporting a consortium of two private equity companies. And we worked alongside a range of due diligence advisors in different areas, right? And the different areas were financial due diligence, legal due diligence, operational due diligence, and operational and technology due diligence, which is what my team does, commercial due diligence, and so on. So all of us advisors, we work alongside before the signing and looked at different areas and advised our clients on the different areas. Specific to this situation, it was a carve out. So the main, there were two or three
We may want to specify what a carve out is for some of our listeners. So a carve out is a division is taken out of an existing company, right?
Exactly. It could be a division. It could be, say, part of a division. It could be a few products that are different sort of what we refer to as perimeter, which can be carved out. So, that's exactly that. Carve out is when a private equity firm is buying a part of a company rather than the full company. So in this specific situation, we advise the client on what would be the true cost base of this part of the company when it becomes a standalone company on its own. What it means is this division was part of a larger group earlier. Once the private equity firm purchases it, it will start to operate on its own as a standalone company. So where we advised is from our experience and expertise, we determined what were the dependencies on the group. And once you remove the dependency and form or sort of replicate those functions for this independent company, what is the true cost base of the company?
Because when they are part of this bigger company, I guess they have HR services, legal services, etc., that are shared across all the divisions. And so now you have to think, if these guys are now separate, you need to take into account that they would have to pay for their own HR, their legal, etc. And so you have to reconstruct all these costs. Is that part of the exercise?
Absolutely. And that's that was sort of the key question of the exercise, I would say. So, yes, what would the future business, what would their HR team look like? So it would be HR, finance. In this specific case, there was a complication that one of the manufacturing sites was shared. So how do you separate the manufacturing site? Their IT systems were completely shared. So how do you create an IT system and function from scratch? So yeah, so exactly to your point, Ludovic, it's how do you create that organization as a standalone organization? And that inputs into what is expected to be the true EBITDA in the future. And that EBITDA is what is used by the private equity firm to do the valuation or the pricing of that particular company.
That's very interesting because we talked about valuation and we talk about, you know, you take like the previous EBITDA of these companies and maybe you think about the kind of positive changes you will bring in and then, you know, you can project the future EBITDA. What is very interesting with a carve-out situation that one may not necessarily think of is that it's a bit more complicated than taking a previous EBITDA and projecting because, first of all, it's not clear what the EBITDA of a division is, right? It's not easy to calculate that because exactly. The accounting is not for that division. It's the accounting usually is consolidated at the company level. And so not only you need to think, okay, what was the earnings of this division, which usually you would have, but here what you're describing is that you also have to think about what was the cost of this division when it was part of this company, but what will be the cost then now that it is out, and because of all these additional costs they will face. And so that's exactly. A pretty unique exercise. It makes the cash flow projection, actually, all else equal, much more complicated in a carve-out situation than if you were buying the full company.
Exactly. And that's why due diligence itself is performed within the context of what the private equity firm wants to do with the business, right? So in a carve-out situation, they would want to run it as a standalone. You mentioned synergies, and normally the idea is synergies is only applicable to corporates because they will buy the company and bolt it onto their own company. But sometimes synergies is also applicable for a private equity firm because they may own a company in the portfolio where they may buy another new company and bolt it on together, in which case we look at the potential synergies during the due diligence phase because the combined business will have a cost base or an EBITDA, which is lower than, say, the sum of the parts because of the synergies. Yeah. So the due diligence itself is done with a view of what is the objective of the PE company.
That's right. So if it's a carve-out, but then it's going to be what we call an add-on, or you called it bolt-on. I don't know if there is a difference between an add-on and a bolt-on. But if it's an add-on acquisition, then you have to also take into account that maybe, you know, this company that it will be added to already have an HR function, legal, etc. And so maybe, you know, the cost difference will not be that big. But if it's not an add-on, but it is to be run as a pure standalone, then it will be yet different. And you need to take that into account. And that what I like here is that it illustrates this point I often make that you have to look at the whole exercise as something coherent, is that the due diligence cannot be detached from the valuation exercise, which cannot be detached from the exit route that is being planned, from the entire thing, right? A deal is everything exactly. together in a coherent way. And you cannot say to someone, okay, you do due diligence, then this guy will do the modeling and this guy does something else. It's like everything has to be coherent.
Exactly. And that is a very important point, the coherent point which you just mentioned, because one element is, yes, the different sort of the fact that the valuation has the current view, what they want to do with the future. And the third is the risk view, which is whether the company will fall over even before you run the value creation plan. So it has to be very coherent in terms of these three elements. It also has to be very coherent in the way the different advisors are feeding in. And we, like the different advisors of the various types of due diligence, we work very closely with each other. So one example is we looked at a software business and my team, we looked at the operations and technology areas, whereas another team looked at this, you know, the legal, they did the legal diligence. So we worked in very close, very close interaction with the legal team to feed into the intellectual property implications. So we understand that they have a lot of internal software which they had developed, which generates revenue for the business. We understood whether, you know, those what components of the software is developed internally and therefore is an intellectual property of the business, and what is purchased as a third-party software from suppliers. And that was fed into the legal team, who then looked at the legal implication of transferring that IP to the future business. So that coherent nature is also very applicable in terms of all parties coming together and working together.
It's amazing because I was thinking about that, like how many people are involved? I mean, how many people you need to talk to? It sounds like, you know, if you are not even on your own in your team and there are all these different people you need to talk to, you need to talk to the person who's going to do the valuation model, right? The person who's going to do the risk assessment, the person who's thinking about exit route, the people in the private equity firm who are thinking of buying, all the legal guys you're mentioning. So how many people are involved? How do you manage to coordinate with so many people?
Yeah, I mean, before a deal, it's a very busy time, as you can imagine. And it is driven by one is, of course, the own work, but also this full, very well coordinated actions from different teams. In terms of how many people, so if I take, it depends on the deal size a little bit, but then the chemical company I was referring to, it was, multi-billion dollar deal. On that, from the buy side, or from the side of the private equity consortium, I'm sure there must have been 40, 50 people across different advisors. I know from the sell side, they had, they were basically running the separation of the business, and they had recruited an advisor firm which had close to a 1,000-person team because it was such a complicated separation of the business from the group. So
that's amazing.
It could actually be very large initiative. And in terms of coordination, I mean, one other sort of point to mention is all of this happens within 4 to 5 weeks. So due diligence, the exercise is usually weeks. It's not months because you get access to the company within a very restricted period of time, right? Period of time. Yeah. So this level of coordination, the valuation, the due diligence exercise, it is done at pace and in a very well coordinated fashion.
But does that mean as well that people are also doing this work on the sell side? So we often think, okay, you want to buy a business and therefore you need to know everything about it to do the valuation, etc. That feels like natural, right? But the person mm-hmm. who's selling also needs to like do all these things because the person who's selling wants to sell it at a higher price as well. And so what that means is that if you want to buy a business and then you say, well, you know, there was this and that thing that was not so good about the business, like when you're saying, you know, you're doing this costing exercise of like the HR functions and all these things, you would arrive at a number. Well, the sale side also wants to run these numbers and to have an estimate because they want to argue whether your number is accurate or not. Because if they can argue that this number is actually less than what you have estimated, then their business is worth more. So it means you also have all these guys on the other side doing that kind of work, isn't it?
Absolutely. And normally, again, going back to the point that the buy side has access for only 3 or 4 weeks. So they always, a buy side always, the starting point for a buy side is the numbers presented by the sell side. It's usually never from scratch, right? So it's almost like a buy side would diligence the numbers from the sell side.
The sell side starts with like giving you some documents and then you have to argue, but then they need to have some backup to argue back and forth with you. So if we go back to this coordination, you need to coordinate with all your guys, but you also need to communicate constantly with the guys who are selling and their entire team. It sounds like a gigantic thing.
It is. And someone like me, we work on both sell side deals as well as buy side deals, but of course never on the same never on the two sides on the same deal. So on one deal I will either be on the buy side or on the sell side, but then I, for example, right now I'm working on a sell side for a large tech company, and the sell side is work is usually quite long. It's about, sometimes it could be months, like 3 to 6 months. And to your point, it's basically helping the sell side prepare the, not just the documents, but also elements which, you know, from our experience, we think that a buyer might look favorably, not favorably, how to respond to it, how to best prepare for it, and things like that. So you are absolutely right, Ludovic. There are advisors on both sides. And the sell side's incentive is, of course, to make the valuation as high as possible, number one, and also to give comfort to the buyers that work has been done and there is a fair amount of structure, detail behind the numbers. The buy side's incentive is obviously to get the right price, but also the buy side advisors may look at the business from a different lens. So for example, if the buy side has a different plan over what the sell side has presented, then the I'll give an example in a minute. Then the diligence advisors for the buy side will have a different problem set. So one example is in one of the deals, the sell side, they provided their financials for the company. And the buy side, basically after buying the business, wanted to break it up into two different businesses and sell one part of the business and keep the second part. So from me, you know, I was part of the buy side team. So for me, the problem statement was not just to ensure that the sell side's, you know, numbers are fine, but also to provide a buy to my a view to my clients on what the two divisions will look like on a standalone basis. So sometimes the problem statements that, not problem statements, I would say the situations that we are looking at are quite different as well between the buy side advisor and the sell side advisor.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. And so Kajal, you had a very fast career. You're doing extremely well, but you were in an MBA program not that long ago. And do you have any advice for any MBA students who want to be like you one day? Any kind of mistakes you see young people doing in interviews or when they start in a job like yours?
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. And yes, I was in fact a student at Said Business School in 2013. And I mean, in terms of advice, what I would say is very often, I mean, the situation with me was when I joined the business school, my past life experience is in tech. So I was in technology consulting. I was a very nerdy, geeky tech person. When I started the course, I almost had no idea about this whole world of private equity, right? So the one thing which really helps is have a plan, but also come with an open mind. You have no idea about what you might find in the MBA course. Once I sort of, you know, took the, in fact, with you, Ludovic, the course on private equity, I understood, okay, there's a whole world of this area called private equity. And there is a job which fits both my previous experience, but also getting an exposure to this new area of work. So I think that open-mindedness to find out what all are there is very important. Second is, I mean, whenever there's a shift in, say, career where, you know, previously I was in tech and now in the financial industry, there is an initial 1 year, which one and a half years, which is very difficult. I mean, there's a steep learning curve. But it's sort of almost important to be resilient, to absorb very heavily in the first few years. And once someone, you know, gets interested in a sector or someone gets better at it, it the return on that initial investment is very high, and it's very fulfilling to in the career beyond. So I think I would say these two. One is keep an open mind and almost expect like a few years of hard work to learn a new thing.
That's excellent. Very few people appreciate and know that. In fact, I'm converting a lot of people to private equity when they go through my courses, but you're not the first one I kind of converted. Although it's not an objective of mine, it does happen. So Kajal, thank you so much for your contribution. It was absolutely amazing. And you've been doing so well. And I'm very proud of your career path. And I wish you well for the many years
Thank
still
you very
to come
much.
Of a great career.
Thank you very much. I would add, I mean, obviously something like a Said Business School obviously adds a brilliant platform for this. So thank you very much. Appreciate your kind words.
Thank you. Thank you, Kajal. Take care. Don't forget to subscribe. Conversations are not the decision of one.